I just want to take a second to talk about how special our nutrition program is. The food that we create here at Sakara is designed to transform your gut and your microbiome health. And when you do that, you change everything about who you are. You change your mental health, you change your physical health, you change your spiritual health, you change your cellular health.
That diversity of ingredients that you're getting into your body changes the diversity of bacteria in your gut, which is the epicenter of your health. And it supports your total body health, your immune system, your metabolism, your skin clarity and skin health, and how you age. And so I want to invite you, if you haven't tried Sakara before, you don't need to do this whole big shebang, clear your week and your schedule to do it. Figure out what is holding you back from giving yourself this gift, giving this yourself this step on your path to taking really good care of yourself. You deserve to feel good. You deserve to feel nourished in your body. And we are here to help you do that.
And Whit, we just have to say the one thing we always forget to say.
Oh yeah, it's really, really delicious.
We always talk about how it'll transform your body and your health and your microbiome. But man, our chefs are talented. It's delivered to your door, ready to eat. And it is so delicious. And that, by the way, is part of the nutrition, because you should enjoy the path to creating a body you feel good in. It should not feel like you're depriving yourself. I literally just ate chocolate, banana, granola.
I had a cookies and cream parfait.
I was actually thinking when I was pouring the milk this morning, I was like, I can't believe I used to think I had to deprive myself to have a body I felt good in, to have a body I felt sexy in. That's been the biggest change for me. Mm. So that's our wish for all of you, is to give you the food that helps you feel good and sexy.
You can find more details and how to customize your own plan on Sakara.com and enjoy 20% off your first order of our Sakara Signature Nutrition Program with code POD. That's code P-O-D at checkout for 20% off your first order. Order now. Today's guest, Vienna Farron, is one of New York City's most sought-after relationship therapists. She's a licensed marriage and family therapist in practice for more than 15 years and is the founder of a group practice called Mindful Marriage and Family Therapy, where she's helping over 600,000 people all around the world to heal their wounds. She received her Master's of Science in Marriage and Family Therapy from Northwestern University and trained extensively at the Family Institute Betty D. Harris Family and Child Clinic. Her national bestseller, The Origins of You, unlocks a healing process to help us understand our family of origin and teaches us how to break family patterns to help liberate the way we live and love.
Hi, Vienna. Welcome to the Sakara Life podcast.
Thank you for having me. I'm excited to be here, excited to be in conversation with both of you.
Yeah, we have a lot to cover. But first question, what is your mission here on Earth? What are you here to do?
Yeah, so I work with individuals, couples, and families, understanding the family systems that we all grow up in. And my mission is an extension of that. I went through some hard stuff in my own personal life that brought me into this work, clearly. But for me, my mission in life is helping people understand the family systems that they grew up in and helping people resolve the things from the past that are unresolved still in their lives today. We have so many unwanted patterns in our lives as adults. I think anybody listening to the podcast will probably be able to raise their hands that there's something nagging, that there's a conflict that they keep entering into, or a type of person that they keep choosing to date, or a boundary that they struggle to set, even though they promise themselves they will over and over again. And, you know, these unwanted patterns that we can't change are a direct arrow into the irresolution from the past. So, yeah, my goal is to help people walk that path in a really gentle and compassionate way, but in a way that still has us really look at and name and acknowledge the things that need to be seen and acknowledged.
I think, like, when I hear that, and I have your book, The Origins of You, in my hand, and I'm reading through it currently, and how do you even begin
to identify your family systems. Like I read it a lot in your book, you have things like understanding how you feel, like feelings of unworthiness, et cetera. Mm-hmm. But what are the first steps to start to like really unearth what your family kind of origins are?
Yeah. Well, I think so many people really struggle to look back. You know, we don't want to because we're afraid of what we're going to find in Pandora's box, or, you know, there's so many narratives that people have about our parents did the best that they could with what they had, or they were so much better than their grandparents were to them, right? We have so many storylines that keep us from wanting to go there. And so, and to that question, you know, we get to go at a pace that works for us. But I think ultimately, at the end of the day, there's an invitation for us to look at this. And one way that we can do that is by working through this book. I think another easy way, though, if you're listening right now, is like, where in your life are you the most reactive? Right? Like what? Because reactivity is such a neon sign. It's like an arrow that points us back to the irresolution. If we blow things out of proportion, we feel like we have a big response to something that doesn't make a whole lot of sense in the moment. We know it's historical, right? We know that we as human beings make sense with context, but sometimes moments are out of context, right? And so like these are really good intro points into it. Some people become really protective of their family systems. We want to be grateful. We want to respect them. We don't want to throw them under the bus. We don't want to blame. We don't want to point fingers. We don't want to stay in that position. And I think my mission in this work is not to do that at all, but to gently be able to acknowledge what's there. So one of the most important questions someone ever asked me was like, what is the thing that you needed most as a child and not get? And, you know, that question, sometimes people feel it in a really significant way when you hear it for the first time. And other times people hear that question and they rattle off. They're like, it was great. I had everything that I needed. Like everything was fine, right? And I generally challenge people to just sit with that question and try to find an answer to it and put a period at the end of the sentence instead of putting an explanation or a rationalization or like something that moves us away from the thing that we craved and the thing that we needed. What we know for sure are that our parents and the adults in our lives were, you know, imperfect and they missed the mark and they disappointed us sometimes, or you know, they got it wrong. And it's not like we're going on a wild goose chase, but we are needing to name and face the things that did happen and give them a little bit of airtime. So those are some good ways to get into the work.
And is it often something that people can pinpoint? Like, oh, there was this one time, you know, when I was 5 years old and my parent did XYZ, or is it things that happen over the course of time and it's harder to realize that it was multiple things, and when you put them all together over the course of time, it made one big thing?
Yeah.
What do you see?
Both. I think for some people, it's really obvious what their stories are. You know, you'll have people who have some big stuff and they're like, here's what happened. I know that this is what happened. I know that this is how it affected me. And then there's other people who, you know, maybe struggle to see it. Maybe there isn't something that's super acute and a big moment in their lives, and it might be more of the subtle repetition of something that doesn't stand out to them as super significant, but it did actually strip away at their worthiness or feeling like a priority to their parent. You know, I think sometimes when we're able to rationalize something, like for example, you know, my dad was working all of the time, but he had to work all of the time because he was the breadwinner and he was providing for the family. And so that's why he was away all the time. Right? Like, that's such a common one, but it doesn't change the fact that someone still maybe didn't feel prioritized by their father, right? Like that they didn't actually get quality time with him, that they didn't actually get to like really know him or be known by him and spend the time that, you know, they wanted with him. So it's like, sometimes it's in the subtleties. It's certainly not always things that are malintended or abusive. In one part of the book, in the prioritization chapter, I talk about a client whose alias is Andre, and he has a single mom whom he loves dearly and respects, and she works multiple jobs and doubles every single day except on Sundays. She goes to church with him. They go to brunch afterwards, but that's the only time that they get. And he would be able to sit in session with me and rationalize, like, this is her way of prioritizing me, right? She's doing everything she possibly can to make sure that I have a great life and that I have things that maybe she didn't have, but it didn't change the fact that he still craved and wanted more time to be prioritized by her through time spent with him. And so this is a really good example of a parent who's absolutely doing her best, who's not a malintended parent, who's not abusive, who's not negligent, right? Who's not doing anything out to get her child. It's a byproduct of life's circumstances. And I think sometimes when we can rationalize things or there is an explanation for why something couldn't happen, it's really easy for us to put space between it. It's really easy for us to like minimize it and distort it and kind of like place it in a box and not actually make contact with naming the impact that it had on us.
But it's almost like you're taking the blame off of the parent and the shame of this thing and making it, it's okay that you had those feelings. Even if she was doing her best and all those things, it's okay to feel those feelings and not to necessarily make it a negative, but just recognize that those feelings exist or existed in that time so that you can then move forward from that place of witnessing and seeing those feelings.
I think the fear of being ungrateful for some people makes it so hard to just name it. It's like exactly what I try to do is that we're not here to blame or hate. Like you don't have to go through this work out to hate your parents or the adults in your life. And some people will, right? So obviously there's certain scenarios in which and people really are cut off and at odds with them. But I think most of the time, the majority of the people that I know that I've worked with still want to have a relationship with their family. They just want to figure out, can I simultaneously sort of like honor and respect you while also honoring and respecting what my experience was? And I think that that's a path that you have to tiptoe, and it's very nuanced, and it's also artistic almost, because this idea that if I say that I was hurt, then I'm tipping over into this place of being ungrateful or disliking you or blaming you, right? Like, it's something that keeps us from naming things in the first place, right? So we have to get comfortable with, I can honor and respect you while also acknowledging what my experience and story is.
And this is what you kind of call the origin, or I guess why you call it, right? The origin healing work. It's this idea of, are those family systems you're speaking to absolutely created trauma? It's not if, right? It's like, you know, both Whitney and I are parents, so I definitely want to get into this.
Yes.
But before we get into like parenthood and what it means to raise humans, it's like this idea of my childhood informs trauma and that trauma informs behavior. Can you speak to kind of the link between all of that? Because I also think sometimes, well, I won't speak for people I don't know. For myself, when I've been in therapy, I have had in the past, now I see some of the patterns. I haven't had a hard time like blaming my mom because I, you know, I grew up with a single mom as well, as did Whitney. I can recognize the places where she couldn't show up. It's more that I don't know, this might get more into like the spiritual aspects of kind of what I believe, that I'm so much more than just my childhood, and that my trauma maybe isn't just informed by this lifetime or just my mom or family dynamics, but maybe lifetimes or, you know, my soul's path. And so sometimes I have a really hard time pinpointing it to childhood frameworks. But now that I'm kind of much deeper in the work, I definitely see how so many of those kind of origins of my childhood have informed a lot of my behavior now. So how do those two link, and how do you kind of start to recognize the link? Because in your example, you just said of that man growing up with a single woman, like how did he recognize that just that in itself was hard? Or was it a pattern that you helped him recognize? Like maybe he had a hard time asking for things from his wife, or I don't know what it is.
Totally. Yeah. And I agree with you. I hold the same belief system that there's so much that influences us. And yeah, whether we're talking about lifetimes ago, whether we're talking about other humans in our life story, right? Like coaches and teachers and other people's parents and our friends and society and culture, right? Like all of those things are imprinting. And I'm a big believer that there are as many modalities to this work as there are humans on the planet. But the one thing that I would just challenge in that is that if we're not looking at our family of origin, right, we're missing a huge part. Like certainly, you know, in this lifetime, right, this was the path that we've had. And we have to look at that path. And so, yeah, and that's why we do that. It's our first education here, right? It's like our first education on conflict and communication and love and attachment and boundaries and intimacy and we learn that all from these family systems. So I grew up, my parents went through a 9-year divorce process. It was really long, obviously drawn out. A lot of gaslighting, a lot of manipulation, a lot of psychological abuse, paranoia, emotional flooding, just like super high conflict. And, you know, I'm an only child. And so I was this tiny little kiddo in a family system that was really crashing and burning around me. And as a little girl, kind of saw both of my parents not doing well. And so I believed that there wasn't space for me to also not be doing well. And so I did well and I pretended like I was fine all of the time. And I got good at all the things that I decided to put my energy into. And so I was this tiny little girl, needless little girl who turned into a needless woman. And for a long period of time, even in grad school, when I was doing this work, it was like, oh, my parents' divorce didn't affect me at all. I am good. I'm fine. I'm okay. And it wasn't until like my mid-late 20s where I started to really see how the role from my early childhood was still in my life as an adult in my romantic relationships. And I was needless, boundaryless, wanted to be the quote unquote cool girl in my relationships and pretend like I was fine all of the time because I thought that if I wasn't fine, it would rupture something, right? And I had big aha moments in a particular relationship, but I want to speak specifically to your question, right? Like, how does it show up? So when I was dating my now husband, we were in a conflict and I can't remember for the life of me what the conflict was about at all, but I do remember that I was doubling down, tripling down. I kept proving my point. I kept needing to be right in this argument. And he's like, I got it. I understand. He was like really accommodating and was hearing me. And I kept going, kept going, kept going. Have this out of body moment where I'm like listening to myself continue to go. I'm like, oh my God, Vienna, like stop speaking. Finally, I stop and I like have this moment of shame spiral and like embarrassed and feeling ashamed and like wondering if he's going to want to be in the relationship with me. But then I am able to move my shame into curiosity. And I want to understand what needing to be right and needing to prove my point serves. Like, what's that behavior's function for me? And as I took my like squiggly little line into my family of origin, I realized that, you know, as a little girl and as a kid and as a teenager, right, I watched my dad gaslight and be really manipulative towards my mom. It wasn't towards me, but I was an observer of it. And I watched it turn into crazy making. Like, it really quite literally was crazy making for her. And as an observer of this, I realized that being right was safety, right? It was control, it was power, but it was safety. And being wrong was unsafe. And I was operating through my life in this way, needing to be right, needing to prove my point, not always in conflict, but I was like dominant in certain ways. And I like found ways to make sure that I was always right and invulnerable in many ways too. There is this link to our behavior. These behaviors in our lives today, they do make sense. Our behaviors serve a function always. Like I said earlier, we make sense in context. And sometimes we're like question marks. Why do I do this? I can't believe I did that. This doesn't even make sense. When you hear people say that, the context is missing. We're not looking for an understanding why we're operating in our relationships this way, why we're operating in the world this way. But I can tell you, I can promise you that your behaviors always serve a function, even if the behavior is dysfunctional, right? Like me proving my point, if I continue to do that, I would probably lose relationships. If I continue to operate in the world that way, it probably would not get me very far in romantic relationships or friendships, for example. But it was like, this was an entry point to helping me really connect to, okay, this does come from somewhere. It does serve a function. It is always trying to protect me from something. But now I have to update this operating system from so long ago that says being wrong is unsafe. Well, guess what? Being wrong with my husband is not unsafe. Being wrong with my friends is not unsafe. Being wrong actually with most people is not unsafe. But it's not enough to cognitively understand that. Like, we have to go through some of this healing work. So anyway, it's a long story to respond to your question, but I mean,
but that's huge, that moment right
there.
It's huge. Right? Of understanding that our behaviors come from a place where we developed them for safety.
That's right.
You know, it's like part of evolution. We have all of these behaviors that we've created to protect ourselves, to evolve. But that if we don't update, if we don't reflect and say, do they still serve us, that they could potentially be putting us in a place of where we're not safe then.
Right.
And how much of the healing is then, Whitney and I were having this conversation just before as we were prepping, and your example might be difficult because I am not sure you have this kind of relationship with your father, you may or may not, but like how much of the healing or moving through it is addressing it with him?
Mm-hmm.
Is addressing how that behavior impacted? Like I think about this with my own relationships, kind of origin relationships.
Yeah, it's a great question. You don't need to address it with the person who put it there. If you can, and they're open to it, it's beautiful, honestly. I mean, it's really a special thing that if you can bring something to the person who put it there in the first place, and they're able to receive it and acknowledge it and own it and take accountability and really hear you out, I think that's one of the most healing things that can happen for an individual. But I'm a true believer that we do not need the source of our pain or the source of our wounds or the source of our trauma to be a part of our healing. In fact, probably most of the time, we're not going to get that. And it's good news actually for us that we don't need that, right? Because, you know, sometimes people are deceased, or sometimes it was somebody who was abusive and we don't actually want to re-enter into that dynamic. Maybe the less extreme end of that spectrum. Like, we also just have people who are super defensive, right? Who are stuck in their own shame, who cannot acknowledge and own and, you know, just be in contact with what it is that they did. They have to protect themselves more than they're able to protect the relationship, right? And like that part is hard. And I know, I'm sure we'll get into parenting stuff, but sort of the flip side of that is like, can I protect the relationship over needing to protect myself as a mother? If our children come to us and say, hey, I was like really hurt by this or disappointed in this or let down by this, eventually, maybe they're not doing this right now, but by getting to that place where I am not so much in my own shame or guilt or embarrassment that I need to self-protect instead of relationship protect. So the healing work doesn't require it. And in fact, I think part of it is working towards a place of acceptance that we understand what their limitations are and what their constraints are. And there's a lot of grief work in that. I recently made a post about like acceptance is where the grief is. There's just so much validity to it. It's like to get to this place where I can say, I know you're not able to, right? Sometimes can't, sometimes will not, but sometimes like more can't than we give credit for. I think sometimes when we say will not, that lets us still be just angry with them. You're choosing not to do this versus like sometimes people's shame is so big that they cannot address the things that we want them to address. And when we keep trying to negotiate or bargain, or like if I yell it at you, if I write you a letter, if I say it kindly and softly, if I do it this way, what about that way? Like if I try all these different ways, maybe I'm going to be able to get you to see the thing or hear the thing or understand the thing and acknowledge it. It's like, no, we exhaust ourselves that way, right? It's like to accept that.
I hear that. And also, so then what do you do? I have a similar instance where I kind of know this person cannot handle the truth. Like it's just going to be very defensive. And so then I have to create really clear boundaries. And then the boundaries kind of also make them really uncomfortable. because they're kind of new and they don't understand where they're coming from. And I just can't give as much as I gave now that I know, now that I understand where some of my own behavior comes from and how I dealt with it was very similar, like needless, just being needless. And that now I have needs, and some of those needs mean like not being as available or not being just okay with everything. And so that's made me have to create these boundaries that then I think just upset the system again. And then I have to deal with that. So it feels a little bit like the hamster wheel sometimes.
Yeah, it can feel that way. And you know, I don't know how much this person is in your life. I think if it's someone who is very much in your life, that is really hard. And I think if you're seeing this person and interacting with them on a daily basis, right, it's something that is really challenging to navigate. But I think there is something about, like, we do let the system shake a little bit. And, you know, it's part of it is that, like, we actually are tolerating. We're tolerating what those consequences wind up being. But I hear you, right? The concern is like, okay, if I'm aligning with myself and I'm trying to honor my boundaries, like, all it's doing is causing a little bit more chaos, or just like a different type of chaos than what was before. So, like, pick your poison and, you know, choose wisely.
Yeah.
But yeah, like, if I'm not able to separate out from you further, and I am going to choose to be in relationship with you to some degree, I think there's just something about knowing what to expect and sort of preparing yourself for that, you know, each day, and not being super surprised by unsurprising things. And, you know, if it's like
that's a great line.
Yeah. Like, if it's an important relationship to you, you feel like there's no way for me to communicate the thing to them, I generally tell people, keep communicating it to other people who can hear it, right? So that you're actually letting some of it come out. Know that the consequences here are what they are. And so it's a bit frustrating because we are choosing a different poison and it's hard and challenging to be around. But if you can register each time you're, you know, and again, I don't know how many contact points you have with this person daily or weekly, but just kind of reminding yourself and grounding yourself in for these interactions of what you can expect, that can help a little bit. But it's a tricky relationship. It really is.
I hear that. I really like that line of don't be surprised by things you know are going to happen.
Yeah.
And then be triggered all over again. I really love that. Well, thank you for that personal therapy session. I'd love to talk about relationships. You know, we asked some of our followers what their questions were, and there's a lot about relationships. Are you a personal believer that we choose someone who's going to kind of like bring out our shit?
Mm-hmm. Yeah, I think all of our intimate relationships do that. I think we choose partners who have similar levels of wounding. That doesn't mean that their stories are the same as our stories, but I'm always amazed when someone's like, okay, I'm the messed up one in the relationship. My partner doesn't have anything. And I'm like, oh, no, 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 that is not true. You have similar levels of wounding, even if it doesn't present that way, even if the context of your story is so different. You're not going to partner with someone and choose someone for like a long-term relationship. I don't mean going on a date with someone, but you're not going to choose a relationship with someone where there's too much of a difference there, because you are pulling each other's stuff forward in the relationship. And yeah, relationships are either going to re-wound, or they become the opening for, it's like the other side of the coin. It feels really similar, but it becomes an opening for our healing and walking to a different path.
And do you find people have to be really careful? Because I can imagine being the person where you can kind of pretend. It's a little bit to like the needlessness thing where you're like, I've worked through that, but actually you're just not acknowledging your own needs. Like, when you're in relationship, do you find you have to help people who, I don't know, are trying to do the work, maybe recognize where they think they're doing the work and maybe they're not, and they're actually just swallowing it or coping?
For sure. Yeah. I mean, I think, again, sometimes people's stuff feels really obvious to them and they're like, here's the thing that I definitely need to be working on. And then other times people are coming in sort of like presenting in a certain way where they've almost like perfected the presentation, and it's this idea of who I am, but it's almost like working on the wrong thing.
Yeah, I think that was one of the questions was like I'm doing all the work, like I don't see a shift or feel a change.
I really say this lovingly, you have not then done all of the work, you know, like, I say that so lovingly and with so much compassion, because I think sometimes we can like read the books and do the courses and, you know, all the things, even go to therapy, right? And you're like, I am doing all the work, but nothing is actually shifting. And I think the change is the integration. For me, it's one thing to connect dots in our lives. It's one thing to like understand what's happened or why I do this. It's another thing for us to then integrate that work. And for me, I don't see integration without, you know, grieving and witnessing. And like there's a somatic and emotional thing that we really have to go through.
The hard stuff.
Right. It's not just the knowledge, it's the application that might be even more important than knowing well.
Yeah. And so I think if you don't see a change, my guess is that you probably haven't felt enough. You probably haven't done enough grief work. There is something that's missing there, because if you're doing a lot, and you're not seeing any changes, there is a disconnect between that.
Whit, you are famous for talking about, do you want to be the raisin or do you want to be the grape? And that's really kind of why we designed Beauty Water Drops.
Yeah, so maybe we back up and talk about this raisin and grape analogy that I like to use. You know, people come to us all the time asking about what is the fountain of youth? So I love to talk about what's the difference between a grape and a raisin. And the difference is water. A grape has the smooth skin, it's plump. A raisin is dried and wrinkly. The grape is filled with water and hydration, and the raisin isn't. And so our Saqqara Beauty Water Drops are ionic trace minerals that help your body absorb water better than just pure water alone. So these water drops contain all the major electrolytes plus trace minerals to help the water balance within your cells, to keep your cells hydrated on a better level.
And what's amazing about these beauty water drops is they actually help your cells take up more water.
I love to put our beauty water drops in every glass of water that I drink. I don't think about it like a supplement. I think about it as I'm rewilding my water, turning my water back into that mineral-rich water that it used to be before it was stripped of its minerals and purified and processed before it came out of a tap or went into a bottle, and giving it back those electrolytes and those minerals that our water used to have when it was running through streams and babbling brooks. I can really tell the difference when I'm properly hydrated using those minerals in my water and when I'm not. I really see it in my skin. Those fine lines get plumped up when I'm fully hydrated. And I also feel it in my energy levels. So much of energy comes from being hydrated to be able to function properly, all the processes within our bodies.
Also, they say that focus and kind of attention is really connected to hydration. Your brain is made up of so much water that even a small change in hydration levels can change your brain composition and like make you tired or, you know, give you. So there's a reason like our parents were always like, you're not feeling well, drink some water. Like it really is the kind of like all over medicine, but as long as your body knows how to use it and it needs these cofactors to really utilize the water you're drinking.
You can find more details on Saqqara.com and enjoy 20% off your first 2-pack of our beauty water drops with code POD. That's Saqqara.com, Saqqara.com, promo code POD, POD at checkout.
Great.
Go get your drops.
You also said something my therapist says a lot too, which is like, get curious.
Yeah.
Which I think is such a good one-liner. Like if you can only remember one thing when you're kind of in your peak reactive mode, it's like getting curious instead of blaming, shaming, but like wondering what are the feelings that got you there and kind of where do they come from? is so powerful. It's hard to do, but
it is hard to do, but I think it's one of the most important like tips, tools. Like it seems so simple, but it's like replace all of that other stuff with curiosity as quickly as possible. Because when we can get curious about ourselves, then we do have a direct line into something. And so, you know, I'd encourage this person to say, like, what in my life isn't changing? What about my life do I really want to have change? And what ways am I actually protecting myself by not changing? Mm-hmm. Our resistance mm-hmm. to change serves something. Again, behavior serves function, right? So our resistance to change serves something. What are you protecting? What happens if you change? Conceptually, we're like, oh my gosh, yeah, I want to do this differently. I want to have better boundaries. I want to be able to say no to this person. I want to do all of these things. But we don't recognize like what the consequence is on the other side of that. And sometimes that consequence, right, is like too much for us to tolerate. If I'm going to lose the relationship by changing and I'm not prepared to lose the relationship, then I'm not going to change. Right. And so it's like mm-hmm. we really have to dissect and pull those pieces apart instead of just being frustrated. Like, I've done all the work and nothing is changing. Okay. I've done a lot of work. Beautiful. And my resistance to change or the block around the change is still protecting me from something. So, what is that? Right. And to mm-hmm. see if you can identify that and work from there.
And what if your partner doesn't want to do the work?
I know it's hard. It's really, really challenging. I know to be in partnership with someone who is, yeah, deeply resistant, could care less, like thinks you're silly, crazy for wanting to do that, right? It's like, that's hard stuff. And, you know,
I hear that a lot yeah. in relationships, like women going to therapy and these types of things, and then their partner just saying like, I think I'm okay. Or why would I put my time there?
This is where I've been telling Whitney this. We did this really great exercise at Sakara. You know, we've started this company 12 years ago now. And it was only really like 4 or 5 years ago that we concretized what we call like our mission, our vision, and our values. And though they were the same as they were since origin of Sakara, concretizing them so that the whole team could like read them, repeat them, see them, has done so much for us all kind of having these rallying cries, like something to come together with and having your efforts ladder up to. And the whole point, especially around values at least, is we all have lots of values, but what are the values that make Sakara, Sakara? So some of our values are things like joy or something called science and spirit. And so we have about 5, and I told Whitney I really want to work on one for my family because I'm realizing that there are just so many things I want to teach my kids and that it's overwhelming for me because you have to like repeat them, right? Otherwise, you don't really learn them. And so one of the things I've repeated to them since they were really, I mean, they're still little, but really, really little is like, you can do hard things. There's something for me around seeing obstacles as opportunities. So maybe that reflects that, but when I hear, you know, Whitney's questions about partners not wanting to do work, I have a hard time believing that that could ever really be true. That like, if you came together, there are some things you must value together. And if you could recognize them, that maybe that would be, it's not so personal of like, you have to work on yourself. It's like, oh, we came together. We both value X, Y, Z. Like, how do we both kind of get better at, you know, being more representative of our values? Because I think sometimes I find a lot of my girlfriends just make it so personal toward their partner, where it's like, you have to work on this. This isn't something good about you. I don't appreciate this about you. And it makes the person on the other end really defensive. Which like, so maybe they do want to do the work, but just not in the face of somebody judging them and telling them they should do the work.
Yeah, I think it's a really great perspective. And yeah, I mean, most of the time when we get to that place, it's because there's a lot of resentment that's been built up and there's a lot of like bad blood already. And we're really disconnected and we're not feeling super motivated. And yeah, maybe there's like, again, the resistance serves something or the avoidance serves something. It is interesting because I'll have people come into therapy with me, and you'll have one person who's maybe leading the charge a little bit, and then the second one that's there a bit more begrudgingly. And, you know, I think that this is the beauty of having a third person in the space sometimes. So I think the best therapists are the ones, similarly to what you were just saying, Danielle, that like really merge the art and science of this work. And it's that like intersection of it that allows for the therapeutic process to be this like beautiful, profound, really like magical sometimes experience. And, you know, I think when you sometimes can get a person into the door somewhere, like they want to address something. They just don't know how, or they're tired of being criticized or, you know, ridiculed for it. And, you know, it reminds them of growing up in a family system where they were really criticized too, right? Like, all of that is there. And so when you bring a third person into the mix, it can neutralize some of it. And if you have someone with whom both people can really connect and feel like, okay, this person is seeing me and they get me and they hear me and they're able to hold my experience in this too, then I can participate in this conversation. A lot of times someone else's experience sort of like runs the show and it can kind of drown out the other person's experience in it. And when you're hearing like, I'm the problem, or if I just did this or just did that, like, of course people get to a self-protective place, which might be defensiveness or just shutting down, not wanting to engage, you know, feeling really exhausted by it. And so I do often, I don't think that this is true all of the time, but I'm like, oh, if I can like just get you in the room, then I do think that we can do incredibly beautiful work together. Yeah.
You hear all those kind of sentiments of you have to work on yourself before you can find your match. Like, what are your thoughts on that for anyone listening who hasn't found their person? And yeah, like, do they have to go do all the work first?
Definitely not. That's the good news. You do not need to be in this like entirely resolved place. In fact, I don't think it's possible. It's probably like a medium ground. Like, if you don't know yourself at all, that might be hard. I think there's like almost a responsibility for us when we enter into relationships. So like, yeah, I think it's valuable to know yourself and to have done some work on yourself. But relationships are where so much of our work happens, right? So this idea that in a vacuum, you are going to do all of your healing work on your own individually is bogus and also impossible from my point of view. You can only do so much on your own. If it's relationships that wound, then it is relationships that have to be a part of the healing. You can conceptualize so much. Okay, if this person said this thing to me, here's how I would respond. Or like, if this person on a date, da-da-da-da, like, this is what I would do. Like, you have to go out into the world and you have to be in relationships and you have to live stuff out. I promise in conflict, I will never lose my temper. Okay, enter into conflict, right? Like, notice what comes up there. So no, I don't think that people need to be quote unquote fully healed to enter into relationship. In fact, I think that messaging is so just hurtful for people and just keeps them so stuck. And just this reminder that like relationships, like, that's the playground. It's where so much of the healing actually gets birthed for us. But yeah, you get to be human in relationships for sure.
And I was thinking it also goes both ways. Like, don't expect your partner to be completely perfect and healed.
That's a big one in this day and age with, I feel like, mm-hmm. dating apps. And also maybe, you know, Whitney and I both met our husbands very young. So I think it also might be a product of dating in, you know, your 30s, 40s, 50s, whatever it is, you know, I was really naive when I met my husband. And so I didn't have a laundry list that I think at least a lot of the dear friends in my life have created now that they're older, maybe even like divorced, of like what their partner must be.
We got a question about advice on being single in your late 30s and trusting that one day you'll gain a partner and a family.
So one, I think love finds us at so many different stages of life, which is so beautiful. And also I think, some people do walk through this lifetime without partnering or, you know, having something that's significant. And I think it's okay to also make a little bit of space for that on the table too. I think sometimes it can feel like too fluffy if you're like, I promise you'll find someone. And they're like, how do you know? And we don't. And I think that's the reality of it, is that we're not sure. And also we certainly know that love finds us at different stages and in different ways. But I think it's a beautiful question intersecting with what you were just saying, is like, you know, are we creating standards for ourselves that allow for love to meet us or not? And I know that that's a really tricky conversation. You know, this idea that like you should never settle and raise your bar and you know, and yeah, I mean, of course, to an extent, you want to be loved well and you want to love well, but are you existing in the world in such a way where no one actually has a shot at making contact with you and having intimacy with you and closeness with you? My husband was telling me about a study that came out recently, and where they asked women and men, if you got an 8 out of 10 in a candidate, like, what would you do? How would you respond to that? Overwhelmingly, the women's response was that, like, absolutely not, I'd be settling. And the men's response to that was like, absolutely, like, that's incredible, right? And I think that that's just an interesting piece here for us, where it's like, oh yeah, like, what's the narrative around this, right? This idea that like the partner has to be XYZ and here are the things that I'm clinging to and grasping on, versus like, I recognize in our humanness that we are not perfect, that we bring some not so great stuff to the table too. And you know, we have got to make space for that if we're also going to make space for love and connection.
And that we're picking people that are at the same level of woundedness.
Yeah. Yeah.
I have 2 kids, a 5-year-old girl and 3-year-old boy. And I try to be pretty careful about the media. But sometimes things like in the middle of a movie, they'll say something. I'm like, what? Oh, like, that's such programming. Like, we just watched the newer Beauty and the Beast. And you know, I'm so aware of all the Disney narratives I grew up with, which is happily ever after. And Whitney and I talk about this because we have known each other our whole lives and then our whole married lives as well, and have seen each other go through so many chapters of hard work in our relationships. But nobody told us that was normal. Like, so luckily we had each other. But like, no, you don't grow up learning like, hey, when you do find someone, like, as you said, Vienna, it's the playground. And sometimes the playground really hurts and it's really hard and you have to do something scary and you have to face things and you have to move through it. And you also have to honor that everything comes in waves and chapters and phases, and to expect a 10 out of 10 at the beginning or any time throughout a relationship, it's just so unreasonable. And I wish I would have known, certainly from the culture around me, I wish I would have known how much doing the work is not only normal, but needed. And like, now I just think back and I'm so grateful that I had that playground and still have that playground. But yeah, I think there is this unreasonable expectation in women. One, we were programmed with happily ever after. And now, too, there's something about like dating online where you have to put all your stuff on a profile is so odd, because then you literally have a checklist. Like, if my husband had a profile and I had seen him on, I don't know if I would have clicked. Like, who knows? Like, it makes you intrinsically value things that you're not sure you even really care about.
Yeah.
And then also, like, how do you fall in love with somebody? I can just think back to how you fell in love with your husband, Danielle. It was being in a situation, in a time and a place with an energy and a vibe that created an environment to fall in love, like an element of risk and an element of excitement and, you know, sexy vibes and all these things that could help do that. You know, it's not that sexy to be swiping on each other and then have a, like, let's go meet for a coffee.
Yeah.
Yeah. And like, creating spontaneity and these types of things is harder to do in today's day.
Yeah. I was laughing while you were speaking, Danielle, because I was like, I think maybe the 10 out of 10, like, maybe happens on like random days, you know, where you're like, this is today, 10 out of 10.
Yeah.
But like, yeah, not the average and not what to be Yeah, not what's to be expected.
Or the good days, like where it feels 10 out of 10, the things that would dock a point, you're like, ah, it's okay.
Yeah.
We're doing so well.
We're
like,
doing
you just
so
totally. Like, forget about it. Yeah.
Yeah.
Or even allowing ourselves to not be 10 out of 10. Because some people, you know, they're like, well, in order to get my match that's 10 out of 10, I also need to be at a 10 out of 10. So I still need to exercise and lose 5 more pounds and do all these things before I'm going to find that person. But I think if you could choose an 8 out of 10 and you be your 8 out of 10, and then together you can reach that 10 together.
One of the wounds that I talk about in the book is the worthiness wound. And I think sometimes it's like, this is the stuff that presses on it both ways. Like, I'm only good enough if I get a 10 out of 10. I'm only good enough if I'm a 10 out of 10, right? Like, a lot of times we're really defined by who our partners are too, not just who we are, right? We're like, ooh, if I have this person, here's what everybody's going to think about me. Right? Because a 10 out of 10, we would maybe say is like, quote unquote, perfection, right? And so the worthiness wound rubs up against perfection, right? This idea that I am only good enough, I am only worthy in the world if I am perfect, if I am pleasing, if I am like showing up in the world this way. And so this like continued conquering of this, to me, is actually more an indicator of your relationship with your worth than some fantasy that once we get here, here's what life is going to look like, right? It's like, no, actually, that this is just an extension of you maybe not believing that you get to be a little bit messy and that love is not conditional, that like love is something that, yeah, when you are unshowered for a few days and you're having you're having conflict with your family or you're super reactive or you've just made contact with anger that hasn't ever had a chance to come out for decades and you're just in this space that like, I am still loved and worthy in this dynamic, right? Obviously in life too, but in this dynamic, and I don't have to present a certain way in order to get whatever X, Y, and Z might be.
I know we're just about out of time, but maybe we could just briefly touch on parenthood. From what you've said today, I feel like as a parent, the best thing I can do is make sure my kids are really comfortable telling me about like their feelings about me and like being really open to feedback as a parent and welcoming it. Like, it's a hard thing to swallow, at least for me, that like your kids are absolutely going to have trauma. Like, I feel like I'm actively sometimes looking around being like, oh shoot, is that going to be something that's going to like stick with them? Gentle parenting is very much a thing for our generation. Is that something that you agree with? Do you think that, is it that like every person has 10% trauma in their childhood minimum, and so you're just kind of navigating your best around that? Or do you think something like gentle parenting that's really offering parents the opportunity to treat children like whole humans and validate feelings might equal a generation that has a different relationship to their trauma?
You know, I think sometimes we use the word trauma, sometimes we use the word wounding, sometimes we use the word pain. And, you know, not everybody is going to have like big T trauma stuff that happens in their lives, which is wonderful. And obviously, I think as parents, I'm a parent too, we try to protect and minimize as much of that as possible. One of the most important things that we can do as parents is get to a place where we can acknowledge and own and take responsibility when our children are giving feedback. And I was saying this before, where it's like, to be able to receive feedback means that I get to be curious instead of shameful, right? I move into that space so that I can relationally protect instead of needing to self-protect. Maybe some of the things that our parents really struggle with at times. Feedback is one of the most important things that we need to be able to make space for in any relationship. But if feedback is met with self-protection, it can't go anywhere. And so, you know, when I speak with, I don't work with kids, but I do work with adults who have all been kids. And everybody says, like, all I look for is an acknowledgement, even when it's 20, 30, 40 years later, like acknowledgement, ownership, responsibility, just like, just acknowledge me, that we don't have to go back and change and rewrite what happened, but I just want to have my experience be acknowledged. And so I think this idea of like racing to repair is one of the most important things for us as parents, instead of like racing to defend or racing to be like, explain to your child why it had to be that way or what happened, right? Like race to repair, race to acknowledge, race to hear and listen into their experience. I know it's scary as parents to think like our children, maybe not at the hands of us, but our children are going to experience stuff in life that's going to be hard and hurtful and maybe harmful to a certain degree. And we're going to do our best to protect them, but likely, you know, they're not going to walk through life unscathed at any point. And to some degree, that's part of their work, right? That is part of their work to resolve what needs to be resolved. They're going to be adults at some point. But I think one of my favorite questions to ask parents is when your child is sitting on their therapist's couch, whatever, 15, 20, 25 years from now, you know, how will they describe you as a parent? And I think if you don't like the answer to that, it's a really good invitation for you to explore. And if you're okay with what you think the answer is, great, then you're probably doing a nice job. You're in your humanness and messiness as a parent. But if you don't like what you think their answer is going to be, that's your invitation to adjust. You are going to be human and you're going to get some things wrong and your kids are going to have some wounds somewhere along the way. Maybe they're not going to have big trauma, but they're certainly going to have some wounding that happens where they didn't feel important enough or they didn't feel like they fit in properly or they weren't prioritized or you work too much or da-da-da, whatever it is. And that's their experience. If you can, as quickly as possible, make contact with that and hear them, understand them, listen to them, and also like let that be a mirror back to you. Is there something that you're able to adjust, right? Because if you just keep repeating that over and over and over again, right, it makes the wound deeper. So I know it's a hard question, but it's an important one if you're willing to look.
Well, I feel like this episode was basically all light work. But do you have some light work for our listeners? Something they can do right now or soon to work on themselves and shine their light?
Yeah. You know, I think to me, self-love is the intersection of compassion and grace for ourselves, for the human part of us that missteps and disappoints and gets things wrong, but also with ownership, accountability, and responsibility. To me, self-love without both of those things is like a bit wonky, right? Like, because otherwise you're either way too rigid or you create too many excuses for yourself. And I think there's something about operating in that way that is so important. At the end of my book, there's an exercise that a psychotherapist, Michael Kerr, offers, which is to think of your mother as your grandmother's daughter and see how it shifts your perspective. And I think that that's a really beautiful, not an excuse maker, but a beautiful invitation, right, to like remind ourselves that all of the humans were once tiny little humans in a family system who probably went through some challenging, complex stuff. And, you know, if we can remember that, right, if we can hold that perspective, not as an excuse maker, but just as a context giver, right, like what changes for us when we see our partners as little humans? What changes for us when we see our best friends as little humans? What changes for us, right? And so to me, I think it's so important for us to be walking through this world with grace and compassion, ownership, responsibility, acknowledgement, but to also make space for nuance and complexity. We've lost that art form, I think, in a really big way. And I think it's so important for us to pull that back in and just let that be at the forefront of our relationships and lives.
It's beautiful.
Well, I know what everybody in my family's getting for holidays. They're all getting your book.
On the nightstand.
Whitney is definitely the one that has always lived by, like, everyone is doing their best and really taught me that. Like, if you can really truly know that, then you can offer so much compassion. Everybody's doing the best with what they've been given.
Not take it personally.
Yeah, and that it's not personal. It's them going through their thing and Yeah, that's such a beautiful light work. Thank you.
Yeah, it's beautiful to be able to depersonalize it and to also remember that we can still have the boundary and I don't necessarily...
And the feeling,
I don't have to be in relationship with you, or I can have it look the way that I need it to. But if I can still hold that perspective and hold the grace and kindness and compassion for you as a human being, right, like then something does shift.
Yeah, and I love your idea of making people, like thinking of them as their younger selves, because I have so much space and compassion for my kids. And then when it comes to my partner or, you know, any really like close relationship, it's like the space shrinks. It's like you have expectations of them because they're an adult or whatever. But I love that exercise of imagining them in their own family dynamics and what they've been through. Thank you so much. This was such a beautiful conversation. I learned so much and yeah, really appreciate it. And congratulations on your book. It's amazing.
Thank you. Thanks for having me both.
Great. Thanks, Vienna. That was amazing.
Thank you, guys. Thanks for having me.